The link to this page will have taken you down almost to the bottom of the page where there are three images of Saint Benedict, one on the right beholding the whole of creation in a single ray of light, the second in the middle is Benedict at table with Saint Scholastica, his sister, and the third on the left of Saint Benedict at table with an abbot friend, over the words, "the context of friendship." And this page contains a discussion of Gregory the Great's approach to the notion of friendship. Unlike Ambrose or Cassian, he does not write a treatise on friendship. One finds the issue discussed in particular contexts, often in passing. He presupposes the classical tradition articulated by Cicero, but he applies it in his own special way. And I'd like, first at the bottom section of this page, and then in the text from the dialogues concerning Saint Benedict, which is at the top of this page, to see how his notion of friendship is offered not only, as in the case of Ambrose, primarily to those who have spiritual responsibility for others, for those who have clerical office, or in the case of Cassian, those who are writing to people who live particularly in monastic community. Gregory writes his dialogues for ordinary people. They are astonishingly straightforward tales which are intended to convey a spiritual theological message, and as we'll see, they provide one of the most beautiful instances of an example of how friendship ought to work in terms of nourishing, sustaining, challenging, and enabling the soul, the heart of an individual to grow. So we'll find the theory of friendship articulated here in a couple of texts in the lower section of this page, and the depiction in a kind of a verbal or literary icon form in the image of Saint Benedict in the portion at the top of the page. Now, in the first section, the context of friendship, I describe what we will be looking at in a little more detail at the latter portion of this lecture in the text above. So let's drop down to the second point, which we'll only look at very briefly, and that is that like Cassian and others before him, to some extent Ambrose, Gregory tries to distinguish between a particular kind of friendship or a love that is experienced in friendship as contrasted with the kind of love that one is to have for all. And he borrows perhaps from St. Augustine, although as I said, the distinction is to be found elsewhere as well, in the distinction between loving a friend in God, amicum in te, in writing of God, that's what Augustine says, and loving an enemy for God. Inimicum propter te, I love my enemy on account of or because of God, because God invites me to do this. So there are those whom we love because of God, and there are those whom we love in God. And as you can see, and it's just the citations that are given here in his homilies on the Gospel and his homilies on Ezekiel, St. Gregory the Great mentions this distinction. Then in the third section here at the bottom of the page, the friend as caretaker of another's soul, Gregory coins, adapts something that he finds in the De Officiis of Ambrose, where Ambrose describes piety, pietas, as the guardian of friendship, the custos amicitia. Gregory modifies this into a kind of an etymological discussion, and he changes it so that he defines the friend as the custos anime, or the anime custos. The friend is the one who is the guardian of my soul, the one who stands guard over, who protects the soul. And one can see how this is following upon particularly Ambrose's image of a kind of a kenotic self-opening. Friendship demands, invites me to be open in a radical way with another, and I can only do that with one who is the custos anime, the one who is willing to be the guardian of my soul. One can also see that this is a kind of an image which could be unilateral. That is to say, the guardian of my soul may be someone whom I can trust, but who does not necessarily open their heart to me, and so that can become an image of the spiritual father or the spiritual mother as well. And indeed, it's taken up and used, as you can see, in a whole variety of contexts by St. Isidore, by Alcuin, Rabanus Maurus, and then especially by St. Aelred and some of the later medieval commentators on the Song of Songs. So this definition of the friend as Custos anime, which actually Gregory doesn't describe in any detail. He mentions it, he says it in the homilies on the Gospel and in the Moralia, but he doesn't really provide a clearer picture of it in words. However, he does provide an image of this in what you might call a verbal icon, namely the story of, on the one hand, Benedict and Scholastica, and then on the other, Benedict in the Tower, Benedict's friendship with the Deacon Servandus on the other, in the dialogues. So if we go back now to the very top of this page, we have both these stories given here. And many of you may be familiar with these stories already from their very widespread application in monastic spirituality. There is a whole variety of things that they teach. The primary thing that I'd like to focus on, and there's a very beautiful article by Father Adalbert de Vogüé, which describes the clear sense that this is supposed to be a story about how Benedict himself, as a model of the Christian contemplative, the sincere Christian searcher after God, requires a point in his life where he lays down his miracles, his deeds of power, and becomes a man of vision. And that happens when he discovers the possibility of a deeper loving that is taught him through one who is, in a very real sense, a Custos anime, but offers him exactly the kind of difficult to hear correction, which he reacts rather unhappily with, but which then is an invitation to him to love more deeply, and which enables him to become the kind of person who can behold, as we'll see, the soul of Scholastica ascending to heaven and the whole of creation in a single ray of light. Father de Vogüé's article, which is available on the documents section of the course, is a lovely explication of this story from that perspective. But I believe it's also an opportunity, because this, remember, these stories are written for the laity. They are written for ordinary people. It's a kind of a fleshing out of the notion of what can it be to have a relationship with another where you can open your heart, where even when you feel you're being challenged in a way that you weren't ready for, you may well discover the presence of God leading you to deeper vision, to a deeper kind of growth in love, and what it's like, as we'll see in the case of the Deacon Servandus, to have one with whom your conversation about the spiritual life, your love of that virtue of loving heaven in the other, can be, as Gregory will describe it, a foretaste of the heavenly banquet. And we'll have to move rather quickly through these stories, which deserve to be lingered on, simply because we're looking at them from this perspective of trying to see models of Gregory's notion of the Custos anime. Looking at chapter 33, the form of this story is, of course, of a dialogue, Gregory and his interlocutor, Peter, and it's all about Benedict's discovery of one who does not have the power to obtain what he wills. He becomes powerless in the face of a greater love, and yet that is itself a challenge in the presence of this one who is clearly both his sister and his friend with whom he shares the spiritual life. It's an opportunity for growth. And the fundamental notion, the fundamental theme that recurs throughout this story is holy conversation, sacra colloquia. As you can see in the yellow highlighted text, this is repeated several times. They are speaking about the joys of the heavenly life. Scholastica, a nun, comes to Benedict's monastery. He meets her at a distance from the monastery in a context that's approved. He has come there with his monks in order that it's, even though it's his sister, for it to be a completely proper and above board meeting with this woman. And they're speaking about the joys of the heavenly life. And she, we presume, having an intuition that this is nearly the end of her life on earth, asks him to stay longer. He replies, "What are you saying? I can't possibly stay outside the monastery for any reason." And here, this lovely, winsome story, she works a miracle. She prays to God, and as she lifts up her head, having cried, having wept on the table, the skies respond to her tears by sending down rain, and it's such a thunderstorm that Benedict is incapable of leaving. And in four different ways of describing this, Gregory makes it clear that this is a miraculous event. And then if you drop down a little bit to the text that begins, "Then the man of God, realizing he could not return to the monastery through the thunder, lightning, and driving rain, became deeply annoyed," which is a rather a mild translation of the text and protests, "May God Almighty forgive you, sister, what have you done?" He accuses his sister of having sinned in some way, perhaps of having worked magic or at least working against his will. And she replies, and here is the Custos Anime, the one, even though she's been accused in anger for doing that which comes out of the motion, out of the insight of holy desire that they can continue sharing this beautiful experience of the heavenly life, she doesn't reply with a rebuke. She replies rather gently, "Well, I appeal to you and you refuse to hear me, so I appeal to my Lord, and he has heard me. God has heard me, even though you weren't able to. So go, if you can. Leave me. Return to your monastery." And he is, and here's the theme, powerless to leave the shelter, forced to stay and engage in sacra colloquia, sacra spiritualis vitae colloquia, holy conversation concerning the spiritual life. So here is for Gregory what it means really to be in a communion of friendship, which is the highest kind, where you can communicate with one another about the anagogical, to use Cashin's notion of a form of interpretation that reaches us up towards heaven, an eschatological sharing, a delight in the spiritual life, in the joys that lie literally beyond the external appearance of life itself. This is worth prolonging even to the extent of having to do something that seems to be against the rule. Benedict is cast into the role of the Pharisee who wants to keep the rule literally, and in some ways one might find an echo of Cicero's question, what if you're asked to do something that seems to be against propriety? Well, this is a kind of a delicate turning of the tables. It's not so much something that is against the law, it is what Benedict needs in order to become a man of vision. As Gregory puts it, blocking his will, Benedict discovered a miracle. And by an entirely just judgment, she was the more powerful since hers was the greater love. A clear allusion to Luke 7:44, to Christ's rebuke of Simon the Pharisee, reminding him that the woman who has been weeping over the feet of Christ and anointing them, although she is a sinner, her sins are many are forgiven because she loved more. So she loved greatly. And that is effectively what Gregory is saying Benedict ought to have remembered, but he is being taken into a deeper level of compassion and of loving than he otherwise could have known. And the consequence, the result of this is chapter 34, where Benedict sees his sister's soul leave her body in the form of a dove, penetrate the secret recesses of heaven. He now becomes, throughout the remainder of the dialogues, which aren't very much longer in terms of his life, he becomes a man of vision, not of miracles, but one who sees, who beholds the glory of God. So it is opening one's heart, being touched, having a certain, in a certain sense, the hardness of one's heart opened by the work or the action of a friend, expressing oneself, perhaps even in anger, but then having a gentle response that leads one into the continued sharing of the joy of heaven, the discovery of a deeper possibility of loving, which enables one to become a true contemplative. That's what this story depicts. And now we have, in chapter 35, under the two pictures, the one of Albrecht Dürer's depiction of Benedict beholding the whole of creation in as it were, a single ray of light, the whole of the world together, and a medieval depiction of Benedict at table, we have a lovely description of this kind of mutual friendship which Benedict enjoyed with another abbot, the deacon Servandus. And again, almost just in passing, Gregory describes the idea that this other abbot came to pay a visit, as was his custom. This was not something unusual, this was ordinary, to visit Benedict, and the description of what they did is a beautiful depiction of this mutual sharing, which we've seen in Benedict and Scholastica, but here it's more a sharing between equals, in which the opening of the heart is also a foretaste of heaven, that he, referring to Servandus, and this is the highlighted text, infused with spiritual wisdom and heavenly grace, and Benedict might mutually imbue one another with the sweet words of life. Proclaiming the good news is an opening out to the joys of heaven. And the delightful banquet of their heavenly homeland, which they were not yet able to enjoy perfectly, but for which they longed, could at least be tasted. They are in their holy conversation, in the opening of their hearts to one another, anticipating the joys of heaven. And so Gregory depicts this now in a very vivid way. Benedict has a vision. If you look at number 2 or section 2, when the hour of rest arrives, Benedict retires to the upper part of a tower. Servandus is in the lower part of the abbey, in an area still connected in the tower by a stairway. And in front of the tower stood the large buildings where their disciples slept. A depiction of the leaders of their community, as it were, surrounded by or leading in a kind of moving ahead in the spirit way of their own respective communities. Benedict keeps vigil while the brethren sleep, and as he stood before the window praying to Almighty God, he has a vision. And the vision is an outpouring of light that shines with such splendor that it surpasses the light of day, illuminating all darkness. Then there's a marvel that follows this. The whole world was gathered together beneath a single sunbeam and brought before his eyes. Sub uno solis radio collectus, ante oculus eius adductus est. This single ray of light, this single scintillating sunbeam is brought before his eyes, and the Venerable Father intently fixed his eyes on this brilliant scintillating light, and as it were, this vision of the whole world is suddenly focused down into the world where Benedict actually lives, and as with the miracle of Scholastica, or the vision of Scholastica, he beholds the soul of Germanus, Bishop of Capua, being carried by the angels to heaven. Well, the intriguing thing, of course, is that this vision is now described as something which Benedict wants to share with his friend Servandus. It's not just happening in his own head. It has some connection with the outer world. So, awakened, he sends for Servandus, and Servandus sees a little bit of of the departing light, and they then send a messenger to make sure that the latter portion of it, the seeing of the soul of Germanus ascending to heaven, was in fact connected to reality, and it was. So it's a kind of a validation of the vision. But what we have in the vision is something that begins with this mutual experience of imbuing one another with the words of life, lifting one another up through sharing the joys of heaven, which we saw in Scholastica, and then here, allowing one through that, after that experience, to be one who beholds the whole of creation, as it were, within a ray of light. And what we then have in sections 5 and following is an attempt on the part of Gregory to describe how this is possible. How can one behold the whole of creation, as it were, brought before one's eyes? And his answer is that to the soul beholding its creator, all created things seem narrow. And this is a kind of an alternation now between the idea of the widened heart, the opened up interior self, and the experience of creation that sometimes seems to be narrow or angusta. This narrowness is probably best experienced if you walk slowly into the corner of a room and experience the walls drawing closer and closer, and you find yourself in this narrow, enclosed space. That is what the term angusta refers to, and this is what Gregory is describing Benedict as having been freed from. To the soul that can finally behold its creator, the creation itself will seem narrow by comparison, and what happens is that one's innermost narrowness is widened. Laxatur sinus, he says, the heart or the innermost self. Literally the breast, the place on which in the Gospel of John the beloved disciple rests his head. This place within the self is widened, opened out, as he puts it, expanditur in Deo. It expands in God, and contemplation enables the soul to rise above itself and interioribus ampliatur. Its own innermost self, its own interior self, is amplified, is widened, is expanded out. And so all of this is a way of pointing out that for Gregory the Great, the experience of having one with whom one can open one's heart enables one to become a better contemplative. It enables one to share with another the joys of heaven, to grow into an ability to see God within and as it were, scintillating within the whole of creation. And it presupposes a willingness in this relationship to be challenged to a deeper growth, as Benedict was with Scholastica, and to learn a greater loving that enables one to move into this context of spiritual vision. So for Benedict, having a custos anime, or being that for another, is to facilitate the widening of the heart that enables the other more clearly to see God.